morning, and thank you, Mick, for that kind introduction. And also thank you for the opportunity to come and speak today about some of the challenges and opportunities facing the farming sector in Australia. Perhaps more than any other sector in the Australian economy, farmers understand uncertainty. They live with uncertainty about rainfall and climatic conditions. They live with uncertainty about the key costs or the costs of their key inputs. And they live with uncertainty about the world prices for their output. It's this ability to deal with uncertainty that I think is one of the strong and enduring characteristics of the Australian farming sector. So this morning, I'd like to start by talking a little bit about some of the uncertainties that are currently facing the global economy. I then want to discuss why it is that despite these uncertainties, the medium-term global environment facing the Australian farming sector is, I think, quite favourable. And then finally, I'd like to briefly touch on current conditions in the Australian farming sector. At the moment, the world economy is clearly experiencing very difficult times. Financial markets around the world remain captivated by the unfolding events in Europe. The authorities are dealing with a very difficult combination of excess government debt and weak banking systems, and the problems are being compounded by the weak growth prospects in the region and the fear of widespread contagion. Now, this situation is in part a legacy of many years in which a number of governments spent much more than they raised in taxes, with the bondholders being more than willing to finance the difference at very low interest rates. And it's been compounded by the fact that the policy options facing the members of a currency union are much more restricted than those that would face a country with its own currency. In preparing the Reserve Bank's latest forecast on the world economy, we've assumed that the European authorities do enough to avert a real disaster, but are not able to avoid periodic bouts of considerable market volatility and uncertainty, and we saw another one of those bouts last night. There are, of course, a range of other scenarios, many of which, unfortunately, remain on the downside. And this inevitably means that there's likely to be considerable uncertainty about the global economy for some time. But amongst the gloom that we see coming from Europe, it is important not to lose sight of what's going on elsewhere in the world. In the United States, the recent economic data have been generally better than they were earlier in the year. It now seems clearer than it was a few months ago that temporary factors, including a rise in oil prices and the supply chain disruptions from the Japanese earthquake, contributed to the weak US data earlier in the year. As is normal, though, for a country having experienced a financial crisis, the recovery in economic activity there has been slower than normal. Nonetheless, corporate balance sheets in the United States remain in good shape, and a pickup in investment seems to be underway. And importantly, there are a few signs that the recent financial turbulence has led to the significant deferral of capital spending that occurred in 2008 and 2009 and did so much damage to the world economy at that time. In Asia, growth remains firm, although it's below the pace of last year. This moderation in growth partly reflects a general tightening of macroeconomic policy over the past 12 months in response to a pickup in inflation in the region. Recently, there have also been some indications that the weakness in the North Atlantic economies is having an effect in the region, with growth in Asia's exports having slowed in recent months. But taking a slightly longer-term perspective, one encouraging development in the region is that domestic demand appears to be growing quite strongly. And this is important because over the years ahead, Asia will need to rely more on domestic consumption than on exports to drive its growth. And to do this, further policy reforms are going to be needed in the region. But I think the good news is progress is being made on that front. So the global economy at the moment is in a very difficult position, and the challenges facing policymakers are complex. Over the course of the next year, we expect growth to be slightly below trend in the global economy. It's noteworthy that around three quarters of the expected growth in global output over the next year is expected to come from the emerging and developing world. This is a very marked change from the experience in previous decades, when it was the advanced economies that accounted for the bulk of global growth. From Australia's perspective, global growth a little below average would make for a relatively benign international backdrop. The difficulty for many advanced economies is that average growth or below average growth will not allow them to make inroads into their very high levels of unemployment and high levels of excess capacity, and that's likely to create economic and social tensions in these countries for some time to come. I'd now like to change tack a bit and to look beyond these global macroeconomic risks to the medium-term global outlook facing the farming sector. And I think here the news is more positive. In short, farming is benefiting from some of the same underlying forces that have led to an improvement in the outlook for the mining sector, namely the development of Asia and the steady rise in incomes of the many hundreds of millions of people who live on the Asian continent. As incomes there rise, especially from low levels, food consumption has increased, and the increase is concentrated in food with relatively high value added. As you know, there's also growing demand for agricultural products for energy production, and this increase in demand is occurring at a time when global growth in agricultural productivity has been slow by the standards of previous decades. But this changing balance in global supply and demand can be seen in the global prices of agricultural goods, which have increased significantly. And you can see this in this chart, which shows the IMF's Global Food Price Index. It's almost doubled over the past decade after it had been trending lower in the 1980s and the 1990s. Well, after adjusting for inflation, food prices are still below the average of the 20th century. The downward trend evident over most of the past 100 years appears to have stopped. I think looking forward, there are reasonable prospects that the higher prices are not just a temporary development. For example, in its latest review of world agriculture, the OECD is predicting that the prices of a wide range of agricultural products over the next decade will be 20 to 30% higher than their average over the past decade, and that's after adjusting for general inflation. Now, these higher prices for agricultural commodities, together with the greater volatility, has attracted the attention of policymakers right around the world. And just last week, the G20 issued a comprehensive report looking at the reasons for these developments. The central conclusion of that report, and here I quote, is that marked shifts in the physical supply-demand balance have been the main driver of the price fluctuations over the past 10 years, and that for many commodities, the expansion of supply has fallen short of buoyant demand. Now, this buoyant demand for agricultural commodities is being underpinned by rising food consumption per capita as income rises, particularly in Asia. As you can see from this chart, since the 1960s, the number of kilojoules consumed on average per person across the planet has increased by almost 30%. That's shown by the green line there on the left-hand side. In China, the rise in average food consumption has been larger than this, with food consumption per capita there increasing by around 50%, by more than doubling over the past 50 years. And as you can see in recent times, there's also been a significant increase in average food consumption in the world's least developed countries, after there'd been little growth in average food consumption in those countries for many years. If we look at the cross-country data, it's clear that higher-income countries consume much larger quantities of meat and sugar per person than to lower-income countries. And you can see this in this chart, which plots data for 160 countries showing the level of per capita income and the human consumption of various types of food. From the left-hand panel, it's obvious that there's little growth in human consumption of grains as incomes rise. But overall demand for grains does rise with income, given the use of grains as an input into animal food. Now, one implication of these findings is that as average incomes increase over time, there's a tendency to consume more protein, especially meat. And over the years ahead, this switch in diets is likely to see strong underlying growth in demand for a wide range of agricultural commodities. Another factor adding to global demand has been an increase in the use of agricultural commodities for non-food purposes, particularly for biofuels. In the United States, for example, bioethanol production now uses more than one-third of the total corn crop, and in Brazil, sugarcane is used extensively to produce ethanol. Globally, the OECD estimates that almost one-quarter of total sugarcane production is now used for non-food purposes, and as you can see in this chart, this share is expected to increase significantly over the years ahead. And similarly, a substantial rise is expected in the use of vegetable oil for purposes other than food as well. Now, these developments on the global demand side have coincided with relatively modest expansion on the global supply side. In the years prior to the most recent surge in demand, global research into improving yields was low, as was investment in expanding the supply of arable land. And I think this is one of the consequences of the low level of prices in the 1980s and the 1990s. The result has been that the rate of growth in yields has slowed, as you can see from the green bars in this chart. There's also been relatively little growth in the area devoted to agricultural production around the world, and that's partly due to the urbanisation process in Asia. Another factor that has affected global supply has been an increase in the frequency of reported extreme weather events, including droughts, floods and high temperatures, and export bans imposed by some countries have also reduced the supply coming onto global markets. All up, these fundamental global drivers of supply and demand, I think, are reasonably favourable for the Australian farming sector. No doubt, global prices will continue to fluctuate in a wide range, and there'll be problems in individual markets. But the overall external environment is, I think, likely to be a relatively favourable one over the medium term. And this favourable external environment is being driven by some of the same underlying factors that have improved the outlook for the Australian mining sector. In the remaining time, I'd like to turn briefly to recent developments in the Australian agricultural sector. I think to begin with, it's worth noting that the high prices of agricultural commodities in global markets have flowed through into higher prices for many commodities in our domestic markets. However, the higher exchange rate has meant that the increase in Australian dollar prices has been less than the increase in foreign currency prices. And you can see this in this chart, which shows the IMF's food price index that I showed earlier, but this time in both foreign currency and Australian dollar terms. In Australian dollars, the index has increased by 40% since 2004. This is substantially less than the increase in foreign currency terms, but it's significant nevertheless. I think the other notable feature of this graph is that the long-run swings in Australian dollar prices tend to be smaller than those in foreign currency prices. This is another illustration of the stabilising effects of a floating exchange rate. When commodity prices have been high, the exchange rate tends to be high, and when commodity prices are low, the exchange rate tends to be low, and this has smoothed out fluctuations in domestic prices. And this is providing an important source of stability for the economy as a whole. At the individual commodity level, there have been substantial increases in the prices of a number of commodities over recent years in Australian dollar terms, and you can see some of those in this chart here. While prices at the moment are generally lower than they were earlier in the year, partly due to the problems in the global economy that I talked about before, most prices are substantially higher than they were a decade ago. And this is true for a number of other commodities, which I haven't shown this graph, and there I would include lamb prices and the prices of many dairy products. Now, this rise in prices is the good news for domestic producers. The bad news is that some of the same forces that have driven up the global prices of output have also driven up the prices of many inputs used by the farming sector. And here, the obvious examples are fuel, fertiliser and seed. And for some parts of the industry, these increases in costs have been a significant constraint on profitability. It's also important to recognise that there are substantial differences in the current situation across commodities. In particular, the producers of commodities whose global prices have not risen have found the exchange rate appreciation and higher input costs have had a significant effect on their competitive position. And one clear example of this is the wine industry, where the prices of grapes internationally has not shown the same general pattern as that for most other commodities. And the Australian dollar price of grapes has fallen significantly, as you can see from the line on this chart. As a result of this fall, the average Australian dollar export price for wine has declined by around 40% over the past decade, and production has fallen a bit in recent years. And according to its latest assessment, ABARES doesn't expect any reversal in this trend in prices anytime soon. And a similar, although less dramatic, picture is also evident for a number of other horticultural products. Turning now to the value of output as opposed to the price of output, the recent aggregate outcomes for the farm sector have also been generally favourable. According to the ABS, farm GDP increased by almost 10% in the past financial year, boosted by the higher level of rainfall. And one clear example of this is the winter wheat crop, which is expected to be a near-record harvest of around 40 million tonnes, and this follows a good harvest last year. If we take a somewhat longer perspective, farm output has increased by around 70% since the mid-1990s, although over that period there have obviously been a number of quite bad years due to the drought. As you can see in this next chart, this combination of generally high prices and high output has produced a substantial boost to aggregate income of the farming sector over the past financial year, and another favourable outcome is expected this year. After adjusting for inflation, farm incomes over these 2 years are expected to be almost double the average of the previous 2 decades. As I mentioned a moment ago, the picture isn't uniform across the industry, and some parts of the sector have experienced difficult conditions over the past year. But overall, the current picture is better than it has been for quite a number of years. Of course, agriculture remains an industry where fortunes can change quickly from year to year. It is also one where very significant structural change has occurred over many decades. And given its importance to the overall Australian economy, it's an industry that the Reserve Bank has paid very close attention to over many years, and we continue to do so. Looking forward, no doubt the fortunes of the industry will continue to wax and wane. And like many other parts of the Australian economy, the farming sector will need to continue the process of structural change. As I've talked about, this process of structural change is being driven in part by the fundamental realignment of global relative prices due to the re-emergence onto the global stage of the populous countries of Asia. This realignment of relative prices is creating new opportunities for Australian agriculture, and I wish you all the success in finding those opportunities and taking advantage of them over the years ahead. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Phil, I'm going to drag you in here. I thought that graph you put up was interesting because most in agriculture would recognise, for example, the 2001 period was one where there was very strong returns to the farm sector in Australia. And at that stage, and I'm only approximating, but I think the exchange rate was about 50 or 60 cents to the dollar US, not where we are at the moment. And I guess there would be many in agriculture say that was the last big injection, that confluence of strong commodity prices and a relatively weak dollar gave the sector that needed capital, if you like, that allowed it to survive the ensuing years. And I guess the worry is that we're heading to an environment that, for example, if we do face soft commodity prices, that we may not have the opportunity for that confluence to occur again, that the dollar won't be down at those sort of levels that advantages a sector like agriculture. Is that, I know the Reserve Bank doesn't predict exchange rates, but is that an issue that is in the thinking of some of the discussions that are occurring?
Well, over time, the exchange rate moves very closely with commodity prices. And if you look back over the 30 years of the floating exchange rate, it's been the key stabilising force on the economy. The reason the exchange rate is high now is because commodity prices are high. And as I tried to outline, commodity prices are high because of what is going on in Asia and in other parts of the emerging world. And I don't see that going away. And the challenge is for the economy to adjust to a structurally high level of the exchange rate and this change in world relative prices. And I think we can do that. There are tremendous opportunities in not only mining, but in agriculture. But to take advantage of those opportunities, we have to be looking at the higher value-added part of the production part. If this set of world relative prices is going to persist, which broadly I think it will, we can't be mass producers of standardised commodities because we are going to find it difficult to compete on that. But we can be producers of high value-added agricultural products, of high value-added products in the manufacturing sector, and resources, and we can do that. And the high exchange rate is part of the process of which that's going to come about.
Snow Barlow, Science Advisory Committee member. But a question to Philip. Do you have any other... You've just given us one potential way that agriculture can remain viable at a high dollar, and you've really told us that probably not going to go down very quickly at all. So are there any other buttons or levers in there other than moving up the value chain for an agricultural sector to survive at a high dollar?
Well, you're moving beyond my area of expertise here. I think I can only offer the general comment that if the exchange rate is going to stay high, we need to be moving up the production chain. And that's just not in agriculture. That is across the entire economy. And if that's the situation we're going to be faced, we need to think about how we're going to do that. And the basis of that must be education, research and development. And I think that applies in agriculture as well. Exactly how that's done, there are people in this room who are going to be much, much better placed than I do. But we have an opportunity here. The basic product that we have is good. The technology we have in the country is good. The know-how and the skills in business are good. And I think we can take advantage of that. Exactly how we do that, that's better left to other people.
Thank you. It's Cameron Thompson from Rural Press. I wondered if you could comment on this report out today of this Victoria University study by the former RBA board member Bob Gregory and Peter Sheehan, saying that the mining boom benefits have peaked and that there are significant impacts for the Australian economy to flow from that. They say that the majority of activity has, or the emphasis has switched over to large LNG projects, and that the deciding factor has been the reduced competitiveness of the Australian dollar. Obviously, you both have interest in this, so I wondered if you could give me some response to them.
I think in the September quarter, so basically where we've just been, the terms of trade are going to be have reached their peak, and that's the highest level in... We have data going back, I think, to the 1860s, and that's the highest level of the terms of trade since the 1860s. But I think given what we've seen in particularly in the iron ore market and some other commodity markets and in agricultural markets, the terms of trade are going to decline a bit over the next few years. And so the boost that we're getting to real national income is going to be less than it has been just recently. That's certainly the case. But the boost we're getting from investment has much more to run. I think it's quite likely that by the time we get to 2013, mining sector investment as a share of GDP will be around 7% of the economy. I mean, that's a staggering number. And aggregate business investment in the country is probably going to be at a higher share of GDP in 50 years. I don't think there's any other advanced economy that can be anywhere near that. So this change in global relative prices has led to a fundamental increase in the return on physical capital in Australia, and as a result of that, we're getting an investment boom, and I think that has much further to run. But I'd agree with the point that the boost to incomes coming from the terms of trade, at least on a quarterly sense, has probably peaked because the terms of trade look like they're coming off now.
David Goodfellow from Macquarie Pastoral Fund. I've been lucky enough over the last 3.5 years to travel extensively across the world talking to people about investing in Australian agriculture, and no doubt we've been successful at that. There are many reasons why people would choose to invest in Australia, one of which is that on relative terms we have reasonably efficient regional infrastructure. And it is one of those issues where agriculture needs to work very closely with the minerals industry because we both move a lot of product to port for export. Yet, as a practitioner in agriculture, I see the quality of our regional infrastructure deteriorating rapidly and the potential for us to lose that as one of our key competitive advantages. I'm interested from both of you as to your views on how important the maintenance of regional infrastructure is to maintain that competitive advantage and what we should be doing, if anything, to really promote a re-look and a reinvestment into regional infrastructure in Australia.
Well, if you look at the figures on public sector infrastructure investment over time, they've trended down. And I think that's partly a result of the government's intentions to keep their high credit ratings and keep debt levels down, and there's been an advantage to that. But the level of public sector investment has moved lower. And I think in transportation, it's one area that's worth taking another look at again, because improvements there can benefit not just the agricultural sector but those who are living and working in regional communities as well. You said people should go to the Pilbara, and I went up to the Pilbara last year, and the mining sector infrastructure is incredible. It's first rate, it's world class, but the town itself suffers because of a lack of investment in infrastructure. And if you talk to the people, the public officials there, they've got lots of stories about the difficulty of attracting people to the town and the services the town can provide. And they're crying out for industry to work with them and the public sector to provide more infrastructure to make those towns more livable. And I think we're going to see that play out in parts of Queensland as well. And it's an issue between the mining sector and to some extent the agricultural sector and the government about who provides that infrastructure to make those towns livable, to make them work for the people who want to live in those towns. So I think it's a shared responsibility, not just a public sector one.
Thanks. My name's Susan Wilson. I'm from Sky News, therefore from the media. My question is for Philip, though please feel free to jump in, Mitch, if you've got anything to say. It was actually about something that Mitch said. He talked about a tendency for politicians, strategists and the Reserve Bank to feel the need to be seen to be solving the problems associated with with the experience, the detrimental experience effects by some parts of the economy as a result of the multi-speed economy, and particularly the structural changes to the economy as a result of the mining boom. So my question is, one of the things that he said, one of the symptoms of that was the high interest rates, and I was just wondering if you had any comment in response to that.
Just a point of order. I didn't say the Reserve Bank. What I said, there was an emerging sentiment amongst the policy makers. Now, I wouldn't put the Reserve Bank in the position of being a policymaker, other than the conduct of monetary policy. So I would certainly not sheet that back to the two economic institutions. I was talking about the general public policy sentiment that's emerging.
Now, Philip.
there is a lot of structural change going on in the economy. In the end, that's coming down to the forces that are resulting from the growth in Asia. As I've said a number of times, it's leading to a fundamental change in world relative prices, and that is causing problems in the North Atlantic because they're on the wrong side of that. For Australia, we're on the right side of that. And so there's a lot of structural change going on. It isn't the result of interest rates. And interest rates now are broadly neutral, in either expansionary for the economy or contractionary for the economy. The changes that we're seeing in the economy are because of these global factors, and that's likely to continue. And as I said before, we have in this country a tremendous opportunity here to take advantage of a change in relative prices that is to our long-term advantage. For the last 50 years, people agonised that the change in relative prices was against us, and people were despairing. And now that's all turned around. And the national policy debate is and should be, how do we best take advantage of that? Because there's a tremendous opportunity here for us here. As I said before, I think it's moving into high value added. It's in research. It's in highly skilled workers, because at this set of relative prices, we are not going to compete in mass produced products. It's going to be in these high value added areas. And monetary policy plays a relatively small part in that. What we can do is to make sure that when you guys out there are making your decisions, you can be confident that inflation will average between 2 and 3% over time. That's what we've done. That's what we continue to do. But we're just setting kind of the background environment in which these big structural forces are playing out.